Good evening, everyone. I want to share with you a story from the 1800s. In the spring of 1872, a young man named Jack Marion was traveling with his friend John Cameron in eastern Nebraska. They were on their way to work on the railroad. They stopped at Jack's mother-in-law Rachel's house to stay for a few days. She washed their clothes, packed their wagon for their journey. They departed on May 2nd, John and Jack, that is, and stopped in nearby Beatrice, Nebraska, for some final supplies. But a few days later, on May 5th, Jack arrived back at Rachel's house late at night. John wasn't with him. Jack, in fact, was wearing John's boots that he had tried to trade for earlier on their journey. John's trunk, containing all his belongings, were still in the wagon, just as Rachel had packed them. Suspicions arose. The next day, Jack's wife Lydia and her mother Rachel started asking questions about John's whereabouts. Where was he? What happened? Jack explained how he had bought all of John's belongings, and John decided to go on to work on the railroad. Well, Jack was not well liked by his mother-in-law. In fact, it was due to his reputation as a gambler, a swindler, and womanizer. Lydia even mentioned a rumor that he may have killed someone before. So they didn't believe his explanation, and they accused him of murdering John. Jack, fearing for his safety, he took off again before word got to the sheriff. John never made it to the railroad. His family didn't hear from him, so they started searching, but they couldn't find him. In March of the next year, a skeleton was found 15 miles southwest of Beatrice, buried in a muddy creek with 3 bullet holes in the skull. The body had John's clothes on that Rachel remembered him wearing the day they departed. So the sheriff put out a warrant for Jack's arrest for murder. They may have found John, but Jack was nowhere to be found. Eleven years later, Jack was arrested in southwest Kansas for the theft of a wagon. Word got to the sheriff in Beatrice, and he went down and brought him back to Nebraska to try him for murder. Rachel was the star witness in the trial. The town was out for blood. They wanted justice. One newspaper claimed that Beatrice had a crying demand for blood among the populace. Jack's defense was no help. All the evidence was circumstantial. After a trial, several years of delays and appeals, Jack was eventually convicted and sentenced to execution by hanging. as he stood on the gallows, his last words were, "I am willing to confess that I am a sinner, the same as other men. I have made no confession, and I have none to make. God help foes and friends. God help everybody." Jack was executed that day, and Jack's uncle was in the audience, but couldn't believe the charge and conviction, and set off searching for the truth. 4 years later, Jack's uncle was standing in front of John Cameron, living in the middle of Kansas, alive and well. There was no murder. John explained that he had been on the run himself, in fear of a woman with whom he had an illegitimate child. An innocent man hung to death. Jack was pardoned by the governor of Nebraska 100 years after his death. Think about how the sequence of events could have changed had Jack not had that bad reputation. Would his mother-in-law have so easily accused him of murder? Would she have taken the witness stand against him? Besides that, would he have ever been found again after going on the lam? Had he not been caught stealing a wagon? Let's not limit this only to Jack. Would John have disappeared for so long unaware of his friend's demise? Had he not fathered a child out of wedlock? Our actions, our reputation can have consequences far beyond what can be perceived. I want to read Psalm 15. Lord, who may dwell in your sacred tent? Who may live on your holy mountain? The one whose walk is blameless, who does what is righteous, who speaks truth from their heart, whose tongue utters no slander, who does no wrong to a neighbor, and casts no slur on others, who despises a vile person, but honors those who fear the Lord, who keeps an oath even when it hurts, and does not change their mind, who lends money to the poor without interest, who does not accept a bribe against the innocent. Whoever does these things will never be shaken. God calls his people to be blameless, to be above reproach. This is an important qualification for overseers and deacons, as written in 1 Timothy chapter 3. Living a blameless life means to have such a good reputation that no one may rebuke you or bring charges against you that will be considered legitimate. Any accusation of serious wrongdoing is met with immediate disbelief by those who know you. Let's examine Paul as he arrives in Jerusalem in Acts 21. The saints there receive him, but are concerned for his safety, fearing the Jews will seek out and destroy him by bringing false accusations. They decide to send Paul with four men to be purified according to the law. In Acts 21, verse 24, they say, "Then everyone will know there is no truth to these reports about you, but that you yourself are living in obedience to the law." The next day, Paul and the four men go into the temple. After this, or near the end of the 7 days of purification, they were in the temple when the Jews from Asia recognized Paul. They began to stir up a crowd in verse 28, saying, "Men of Israel, come to our aid. This is the man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people and the law in this place. And besides, he has even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place. For they had previously seen him with Trophimus, the Ephesian, in the city. And they supposed that Paul brought him into the temple." Did Paul teach against the law? Did Paul bring Trophimus, the Ephesian, into the temple, defiling it? Later on in chapter 23, with Paul before Lysias and the Sanhedrin, the Pharisees and Sadducees proceed to get into a dispute about the resurrection of the dead. Verse 9, "Then the Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously, 'We find nothing wrong with this man.'" After Paul was taken away to the barracks, more than 40 of the Jews made an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. It's a good thing Paul's nephew overheard this plot and reported it to the commander. For the commander protected Paul by sending him with 200 soldiers to Caesarea with a note to Felix the governor explaining the situation. In the trial there, Paul makes his defense and says this in Acts 24, starting in verse 14. "But this I admit to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men cherish themselves, that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. In view of this, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience both before God and before men." Here we see the idea of blamelessness being expanded both before God and before men. After hearing both sides, Felix says, "When Lysias the commander comes down, I will decide your case." They return Paul to prison, and 2 years pass. Felix is now succeeded by Festus. Festus then goes up to Jerusalem, and the Jews there petition him for charges against Paul. They were wanting Festus to bring Paul up to Jerusalem so that they could set an ambush and kill him. I don't know where they get their energy if they haven't eaten for 2 years. Instead, Festus decides that the trial should be kept in Caesarea and requested the Jews to bring their charges there. So they do in Acts 25. Verse 7. The Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many charges, which they could not prove. While Paul said in his own defense, I have committed no offense either against the law of the Jews or against the temple or against Caesar. Later, King Agrippa arrives in Caesarea with his wife, Bernice, and wants to hear Paul. After Paul makes his testimony, in Acts 26, starting in verse 30, the king stood up, and the governor and Bernice, and those who were sitting with them, and when they had gone aside, they began talking to one another, saying, this man is not doing anything worthy of death or imprisonment. And Agrippa said to Festus, this man might have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. Blameless, above reproach, faultless according to man. Let's also examine Daniel. After Daniel interpreted the inscription on the wall for Belshazzar, who was struck down that night, Darius the Mede received the kingdom. In chapter 6 of Daniel, Darius appointed governors to be in charge of the whole kingdom. But there were three commissioners over them. Daniel was one of the commissioners and was distinguished due to his possession of the Spirit. So Darius planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. But the other commissioners were jealous and sought to destroy Daniel. Chapter 6, verses 3, beginning. Now Daniel, so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities, that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, we will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has to do something with the law of his God. So these administrators and satraps went as a group to the king and said, may King Darius live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except to you, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, your majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered, in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. So King Darius put the decree in writing. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or human being except to you, your majesty, would be thrown into the lion's den? The king answered, "The decree stands in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed." Daniel was so innocent of man's law that they had to create a law contrary to God's will so that they could entrap him. The governors and other commissioners were successful in their scheme. They appealed to Darius, and Daniel was thrown into the lion's den, but was protected by an angel of the Lord who closed the mouths of the lions. Blameless, above reproach, unable to be entrapped by man's law, finding favor with God. This was Daniel. We can find other men who were found blameless. Noah in Genesis 6, verse 8 through 9. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked faithfully with God. For Noah was a man of faith. God spared him and his family, as we read in Hebrews 11, verse 7. By faith, Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen, in reverence prepared an ark for the salvation of his household. And in 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 5, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness, with seven others when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly. Also Job, in Job chapter 1, verse 1. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. Job stayed true to God through many trials that Satan used to try to break his faith. Chapter 2, verse 3. Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. And he still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason." What about you? Do you have faults in your life that may cause you to be easily entrapped by the law of man? What about your place of employment? Are you consistently bypassing the rules that the other employees must follow? Or is everyone bypassing the rules and you're just going along? What do you think pleases God? Living a blameless life means having the integrity to put aside lawlessness, turn away from the sin that stains your character, and be reconciled to God who brings forth everlasting life through Christ. This is required of all Christians, to be reconciled to God, as written in Colossians chapter 1, starting in verse 21. And you, who once were alienated and enemies in your mind by wicked works, yet now he has reconciled in the body of his flesh through death to present you holy and blameless and above reproach in his sight. If indeed you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, and are not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you heard, which was preached to every creature under heaven, of which I, Paul, became a minister. It's not enough to be righteous in our own eyes. Look at the Pharisees and the scribes as described in Matthew chapter 27, starting in verse 25. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you clean the outside of the cup of the dish, but inside they are full of robbery and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and of the dish, so that the outside of it may become clean also. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you are like whitewashed tombs, which on the outside appear beautiful, but on inside they are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. So you too outwardly appear righteous to men, but inwardly you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. It's not enough to attend worship every first day of the week, for we all take the same spiritual food and spiritual drink as described in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1. For I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud that passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. We should be striving, we should strive to be pleasing in God's sight and to be found blameless before God, as Paul mentioned in Acts 24. Christ was also found blameless before man and God. John chapter 19, verse 4. After examining Jesus, Pilate went out again to the Jews and said to them, "Behold, I am bringing him to you so that you may know that I find no guilt in him." God has done his part. He sent his Son to earth to be the perfect sacrifice that washes away our sins. 1 John chapter 1, verse 7. The blood of Jesus, his Son, cleanses us from all sin. If the Lord comes tonight, will you be found blameless before God? We read in 2 Peter chapter 3, starting in verse 10. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief, in which the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the elements will be destroyed with intense heat, and the earth and its works will be burned up. Since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking and hastening for the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be destroyed by burning, and the elements will melt with intense heat. But according to his promise, we are looking for new heavens and new earth in which righteousness dwells. Therefore, beloved, since you look for these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, spotless and blameless. If you aren't blameless and faultless before God, we give you opportunity tonight to be reconciled to him. If you have not been washed in the blood of Christ, been immersed in water to be born again, free from all the sins of your past, all things are ready for you to be baptized tonight. If you are a Christian, but maybe don't have a clear conscience, maybe you need to confess your sins before brethren. If you have to make it public, whatever you need, we invite you to come forward as we stand.